Good morning, Louise.
Good morning, Tracy.
Happy April Fool's Day.
Yes, happy April Fool's.
So did anybody play a joke on you this morning?
No, nature did. I woke up super late. April Fool's, you're going to be late.
And you're also kind of getting over a nasty cold of some kind. Mm-hmm. So
I apologize ahead of time for any random cough attacks.
Sort of lusty, masculine voice that you've got
right now. Yes, I know. The Darth Vader voice.
So I thought it would be fun to have an April Fool's style show today.
Yeah, we're
not
going to
play any jokes on anyone, but we are going to talk about some of the world's greatest frauds and sort of how things have cycled around from appropriation in the early days, copying the masters, through fraudulent times and the best art forgeries, right to today's sort of current art world.
Yeah, great.
In music and visual art and everything.
Yes, because there's a lot of foolhardy people in the arts world, aren't
there? There's a long and sordid history in fraud in the art world. But what's interesting is that as a species, we seem to be quite, what's the word? Like we sort of enjoy being fooled. Mm-hmm. We seem to get sucked in fairly easily. Mm-hmm. And we think it's fun.
I know.
Sometimes,
that's right. Yeah, I've never been one for April Fools, although I did look up where it came from.
Okay, where it come from?
And in 1582, when the Pope changed from the Julian calendar to the Gregorian calendar, it moved New Year's from what used to be April to January 1st.
Oh.
So, and it was a pretty massive undertaking to change the calendar. Can you imagine?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I guess what would happen is, part of the population didn't really take on the change. And so the people who did take on the change would make fun of people who didn't take on the change. And that was usually around April 1st.
Oh.
So they made fools of them for not kind of conforming. And
interesting.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But that is a massive change.
So they're
an
April Fool because they didn't sort of buy into
the new
calendar. Because
they're still thinking, Happy New Year.
Yeah, exactly. So I know. And we sort of tease our way to conformity, I guess.
Yeah. See, is that where, because I've read a few times where they believe that Jesus' birth was actually in the early spring. And so if New Year's, but they tucked it in the celebration of it into the Christmas season because of the solstice celebrations of all the pagan religions.
Huh.
And so that would kind of, for me, that would make a more perfect world if Christmas was in March and New Year's was April 1st and then bang, it's spring.
There you go. Ta-da!
Let's do that.
Yeah.
Let's go back.
Okay. We'll see what the Pope says.
Okay.
He seems like a nice guy.
He does.
Yeah.
I like him. Mm-hmm. And I'm not even Catholic.
There you go. But the Pope is, ha. Get it? Is the Pope Catholic? I love that joke.
Okay, that was the best you could do for April Fool's,
yeah,
right?
Pretty good.
Okay.
All right.
So let's go way back to the beginning of time. Speaking of Jesus, although I have a reference to Mary Magdalene later on, which is funny.
Wow.
But we're not going to go quite far back for faking.
And it's Holy Week, too. So.
Is it really?
Yes.
So it's just an insane week.
I tell you,
it's
the universe
weird.
Is lining up.
Yeah. Everything aligns for us. And you know, every so often we have a show and we think it's really fun. And we pick a topic and we go crazy. And then the next day, it's big news somewhere. Mm-hmm. Whatever we talked about, it just became trending.
Yeah.
Or, you know, this big discovery of some kind and some big writer did something on that same line. So I think we're kind of,
we're just plugged into the...
We're plugged in. Yeah, there we go.
Subconscious of the...
Okay, so let's go way back. So way back in China's Song Dynasty, which is like 960 to 1200 AD or so, there was... That was a long time ago. There was the beginning of art collecting. And so once, of course, there's a market for art, then the stuff starts to happen, right?
Hmm.
And so there's been a lot of masters, a lot of the... art masters at the time, whose works were copied by students and produced en masse for all of these art collectors, which of course were, you know, as soon as there was wealth, as soon as there became wealth, then there became collectors. And as soon as there was money to be had, the students were able to generate multiple copies of the same work and make money.
Yes, it's a market.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So it kind of, that was among the first of the forgeries, sort of, so to speak. And then during the Renaissance in Italy,
Did they think they were forgeries or they're just making money?
Well, Well, that was the thing, is that I don't think that the concept then was to fake it, to try to attribute it to the original artist.
It was just to create it.
It was like, here, I made one just like so-and-so.
Okay.
Right?
Huh.
And so you'll buy this one for not as much money as you would pay for the original. And so it was a market. But the key is to be as good as you could possibly be at duplicating the original work.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if you weren't good at it, you wouldn't sell it.
No, so you were a craftsperson, even if you didn't come up with the original idea. So if you,
but the skill had to be there, because you had to make it so that so that it didn't, you couldn't really tell it apart.
Well, I mean, think many of the masterpieces we see now, I'm sure there are other apprentices and...
Well, this is the thing, because we've got this, like, 1,000-year history of copying the masters as practice.
Mm-hmm.
It's apprenticeship.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what happened in the Renaissance. It was called apprenticeship.
Yeah.
It was not called forgery.
Yes. And yet, that's how they would learn.
Exactly.
Like, there's no way Michelangelo did the whole Sistine Chapel by himself.
You don't think so?
I don't think so.
Well, I'm not sure, but I have a little story about him too.
Oh, okay.
Michelangelo also copied the masters.
Yeah.
Lots of their drawings, and because that was just commonplace. But in fact, Michelangelo was so good at it that even the artists he copied couldn't tell the difference between their own work and Michelangelo's copies.
Ooh, wow.
I know.
That's talent.
It is. That is pretty severe. So he was good. He was very good. But it was not forgery.
But there's no way he could have done that all by himself.
Well,
it would have taken like 100 years.
It took like, 12 years, 20 years? I don't know. I can't remember now. And the Pope beat him.
I'm sure
he beat the living daylights out of him.
Popes weren't as nice as other popes.
Day he would work bloodied and
so many religious
bruised.
References today. Yeah.
The Pope's on our list.
Yeah.
So he was coerced into continuing to work. I would think that there's a very good chance he did at least a huge portion of it on by himself.
But didn't he have a team of apprentices working with him?
I don't know. I would expect he had workers, because he couldn't possibly mix all of his paints. Like, you know, doing anything fresco is, you're working with wet cement, right?
Yeah.
With pigment in it. So he would have to have a team of people actually making it as he used it. But I don't know if they were doing it, if they were drawing it and painting it on there. And remember, this guy was a sculptor. This was like the first painting he ever did.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's quite something.
Yeah. I'd like to see it someday.
Well, you can explore it in detail online. Apparently there's an interactive. You can zoom right in. It's really something.
Well, that would be the way to go, because I understand if you go to see it, you're just,
you're kind of
hurled in
huddled through. Although, if you're homeless in Rome, the Pope's going to open up the chapel so you can sleep there.
Really?
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah. It's because he's a nice guy.
Yeah.
Unlike the other Pope.
Yeah.
Dude.
The one that beat him up
all
the time. Oh, the Pope. We can't get rid of the Pope in this conversation.
He's here. He's just in the conversation.
Okay.
Oh, my goodness.
So,
we were talking about the apprenticeship, learning your craft.
Yeah.
What would have been called apprenticeship and learning your craft from the masters is now sort of thought of as forgery.
Well, that's right. Because then we did go through a time when it really was. And that's because people were secretly doing it. They were actually not saying, this is a great copy. Would you like to buy my copy? But they're saying, look at this. It's attributed to so-and-so. So you might know of Peter Bruegel, the Flemish painter.
Yes.
Peter Bruegel the Elder. Well, Peter Bruegel the Younger famously copied some of his father's works and pawned them off as his father's.
Hmm.
So that was kind of the beginning of that whole secret, the artist being able to do this in their basement. And ha ha, I'm going to make an extra few bucks.
Yeah.
So that went on, and other kinds of forgeries. Right around the same time, like 1700s, 1800s, people were starting to figure out that they could really pull one over on other people.
Hmm.
So for instance, like William Henry Ireland, he forged Shakespeare documents. Because his father was so fascinated with Shakespeare memorabilia.
Yes.
So he just forged all these things just to please his father.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And then to sell.
Well, a lot of stuff we do because of parents.
Oh, for sure.
You know.
Yeah. And then in Britain, for instance, Robert Spring, he, this is late 1870s, he owned a bookstore, and he was famous for autograph forgery. So he would actually like forge the signatures into the books, like into the leaves of the book.
Wow.
And say, oh, look, this one was signed by George Washington.
Nice.
And sell it for several hundred dollars. And be like, yay, the person buying it. Yay, I got a book signed by George Washington. Benjamin Franklin. Anyway, he just did all kinds of, he was really famous for specializing in the presidents. And
wow. And it is a skill.
Oh, yeah.
It's just whether you use your power for evil or for good, right. I guess, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
And then in France, there's another guy who did autograph forgery. This was funny though. This is 1800s. He figured 27,000 autographed documents, manuscripts, books over his very short career, which was like about 8 years. Everybody from Galileo and René Descartes, Isaac Newton, and get this, Mary Magdalene.
Whoa.
Yeah. He even forged a document that he claimed was Mary Magdalene's handwriting.
Oh, come on. Yes. Who could have known what Mary Magdalene's handwriting?
I know.
Did he even have pens then? I mean,
I don't know. But okay, get this. So you know how he was found
out? How?
He wrote a letter that was from Cleopatra to Julius Caesar and claimed it was a love letter between the two of them. But he wrote it in modern French.
Oh, but voyons.
So ridiculous. He got caught. That just makes me wonder about all the other ones. Were they all in modern French? Did they not figure it out until then? Anyway, but that guy was pretty famous for his autograph forgery.
Well, yeah, and sometimes forger, what is a person who does forgery? A forger? A
forgerist.
Forgerist?
Sometimes they're called copyists.
They get away with it because we don't ask enough questions.
I know, and we want to believe. It's like the X-Files. We
want to believe.
We trust. Which is okay. We're a trusting
creature. You can remember,
creature. In
ancient times, most people were illiterate.
Yeah. So we didn't know. How do I know that's George Washington's signature? Like, have I seen it before? No. Because I don't get to visit, you know, American
monuments. But like going back
monuments.
To, you know, Cleopatra and...
Oh, yeah. You're right. Nobody even asked if they had pens back then.
Yeah. You know, like you have to... So you need a healthy amount of
skepticism. I would think. And, well, I just think that everything art, everything that's not, you know, science and math and stuff is a bit ethereal, right? It's like, ooh, and people get fascinated by it and they do
and
get...
because you want to believe. Right. You're right. And we also sometimes we make the wrong assumptions. We just assume it's real. Like,
yeah, because, I don't know, it's like the guilty verdict, right?
Yeah, you gotta kind
presumed
of
innocent
follow your
till proven guilty.
Instinct and go, wait a minute.
Yeah, I don't think we've been following our gut instinct as a species for a long time.
Goes back to last week's topic, paying attention.
Yeah.
And sometimes these things are found out just on a hunch, right?
Yeah.
Hunches are important too.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
You know what? I did this in my fourth year university.
You did?
In fine arts, yes.
Wow.
Because my degree is actually a Bachelor of Arts.
Okay.
I majored in fine arts. I minored in the humanities.
Okay.
Archaeology was my thing.
Okay.
So for my final project, I created a civilization.
Wow.
Yeah.
No big deal. Just created a civilization. Wow.
And, yeah. And okay. I created pottery shards. I did drawings of, arrowhead points. I did big maps. I did a slideshow. I worked a long time on creating the artifacts.
Wow.
And
very cool.
Yeah. And then I did a presentation to my class, like my art class, because of course my archaeology fellows were not aware of all of this. But for my art class, I brought them in to see a civilization that had been recently discovered and brought them into this whole presentation. I even had my archaeology prof in on it. Neil, he was so helpful. It was wonderful. And it was a matriarchal society. And I used all female imagery. I had little female idols, lots of little pregnant, imagery. And so the one fellow in my class, like, I'm showing them all this stuff and how exciting the archaeology world is and this new discovery of this the civilization, the first one that was seen to be entirely matriarchal, and showing them the slideshows and all the pottery shards. And one fellow in my art class was so mad. He was very Christian.
Yes.
And he said, there is no proof that this was a matriarchal-led society. Just because you have female idols and pregnant pottery people, that's not proof. That is not the way that these things worked. And there is this structure. And I mean, he was passionately going crazy. And I tried to keep him going for as long as I could until this other woman in my art class just walked right up into the middle of this conversation and said, "Oh, Tracy, this is awesome. Did you make all this stuff?" And so then I had to go, yeah. And he was just mortified, this guy. It was unbelievable.
How cool, though. Yeah. That's a great story.
Yeah. And I got a good mark.
I bet.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, my prof was impressed. He was a visiting prof from San Francisco, and it was something he'd never seen before anybody do. So that was kind of cool.
That's great.
Yeah. Well, so there's my great forgery.
I mean, it's not to say that forger, that's a terrible word, people who do forgery aren't extremely talented.
Oh, yeah. Oh, the gift is there for sure, right? And in jewelry, there's the story of this amazing Russian goldsmith,
yes,
who was commissioned by the now famous Gokman brothers, who did this a lot, commissioned to create a tiara,
yes,
that was of Greek Greek antiquity sort of style, and he was commissioned to do it and made to make it in a certain style with certain things, and then these brothers brought that to the Louvre and convinced the curators there that it was of Greek antiquity and sold it for, $1 million or whatever.
Wow.
So this poor jeweler, who did an exceptional job and was famous all over the world, was kind of unknowingly made into a forger, which is unfortunate.
It's true.
And these guys did these Gokman brothers did this time and time again for years and years. Mm. Fooled major museums, British Museum, like everybody.
Wow.
And in fact, fooled the Louvre. Eight more times.
See, so, you can fool some of the people some of the time.
Yeah.
And but so not all the time.
This is where it kind of gets a bit crazy, right? Then there's a huge number of these kinds of middlemen deals happening in the 1800s, early 1900s, where they're commissioning artists to do the work.
Yeah, because it's like the art of the sale, too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Someone's got to go in there and...
It's the bottom line.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I, it's so interesting that we all think... somewhere in our lives is hidden some treasure that we can sell. And, it's an original or you hear all those stories about, we thought it was a original Emily Carr or.
Yeah.
Well, because. We all have that secret wish, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Why is that, do you think?
I don't know. There's some idea that there's a hidden treasure and that we can cash it in. I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Coins, like all kinds of things.
Yeah, something must be of value. But, but why do we want it to be of value? Why
I
do
don't
we
know.
Secretly want it to be the special one?
Yes, I'm not sure.
That's kind of interesting.
It is. So there's all these shows now about trying to authenticate.
Yeah, like the Antiques Roadshow.
Yeah.
And that there's a whole bunch of kind of spin-off kind of things where you can go and
porn
sign up.
Stars. Oh, yeah, it's ridiculous.
Yeah, yeah. And find, you can go personally. Well, like they have one in Vernon and Kelowna and Kamloops where you can drag all your stuff there and find out if it's worth something.
Maybe it's the something for nothing.
Maybe. Maybe we like that feeling of winning.
Yeah.
Oh, I got it for $10 at a garage sale and now it's worth $10 million.
Yeah. And then there's people quite the opposite who did get it for $10 at a garage sale but can't get the art world to, to give them any... Right, like that.
Yeah, like that famous
the Jackson Pollock garage sale.
Oh, yeah, right. Yeah.
The garage sale painting.
Yeah.
No one will give her any. I mean, she basically has shown, even through his fingerprints that he did it.
Wow.
But she can't get any street cred. I don't know.
Yeah. Because I think and it's the same thing with that Da Vinci, that little portrait that he did. It's because. A curator can say no now and never be discredited.
Yes.
Right? But if they said yes and then it's not, they would be entirely discredited.
Sure.
So it's
a big risk.
It's easy to say no. Yeah, it's a big risk to say yes, it is. Mm-hmm. So, I think that's all it is everybody's worried about their reputation as an expert.
No, so it's not about right or wrong so much as we all have a role to play in this big power game,
Yeah.
Sometimes something is famous because someone... who was powerful said it was famous.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. Well, and a lot of that happened, and so lots of artists, as they were working for these people who commissioned things, created all sorts of things from pottery shards, Maori culture, to print blocks, like original wood blocks. You know, when a commissioner would, or a middleman, mm-hmm. would bring a print to an artist and say, well, this print was made by my father, and but we've lost the print block in a fire. Can you reproduce the print block? So an artist would reproduce the print block so that this guy would have his special memorabilia. And then this guy would turn around, like, and it'd be like an Albrecht Dürer or something, turn around and make another 200 prints and sell them as originals.
Wow.
Because they can be showed to be originally pulled off of a certain kind of wood. And, mm-hmm. you know, so it's all about getting the authentic,
yeah,
you know, the process being authentic, so that you can not be disproven,
mm-hmm.
or reduces the chances of being found out.
Being disproven,
yeah.
Huh. And yet another part to the art world, like fashion or music, they sort of want everybody to have their own.
Well, we've had a kind of this push for like 30 odd years about originality, that we can't be seen as copying anybody else.
No.
Like that there's plagiarism, and then there's, I don't know, what is it called? Like where you're just copying, and it's just not, it's just
like
not
knockoffs.
Cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, well, like,
well, whether it's a Chanel bag or, right? Counterfeit. Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Counterfeit. That's mm-hmm. where we're going,
mm-hmm.
because that's the problem. That's where we feel ripped off, because we think we're getting something of value. Turns out it's some lowly worker in a giant factory making millions of these, and suddenly there's no authentic energy mm-hmm. in it. So then we feel ripped off.
Oh yeah, it's a huge area for international crime, and you know,
yeah,
the mafia. There's all kinds of,
yeah,
right.
So all of these artists are being
ne'er-do-wells
used,
involved. Yes,
yeah, used for their talent, mm-hmm. and yeah, mm-hmm. it's all just for making the buck.
Yeah,
fooling people.
Exactly.
It's nasty.
And yet, what I sort of meant is, like, fine arts, this idea that there's only one original.
Yeah.
Right, and that's the one you go and see at the art gallery. But whereas fashion and music, there is no original.
Mm.
But we want, you know, and it's successful because more people have it.
Yeah.
Right? So we want people to have Chanel, as many Chanel dresses as we could possibly sell, or Chanel suits as we could possibly sell. And we want, you know, we base the success on how many albums have sold. But you never base a painting's success on, ooh, that painting's a bestseller. It sold like a million coffees already. Right?
You're right.
Yeah. And why is that?
Oh, that's interesting.
It's sort of exclusivity.
Well,
so when it's piece of art or a piece of sculpture.
Well, they're trying in the music industry to do that. Have you heard about the one album
thing? No.
Like this, oh gosh, I wish I'd done my research on this one, but there's a, it was on O'Reilly on Advertising.
Oh, you know, okay.
On the mothership.
Mm-hmm.
And about different ways of marketing music, because of course albums haven't gone platinum now for, you know, a long time, except maybe Taylor Swift or something in the last 10 years. So they're trying to figure out other ways of marketing. And one band produced one album, one single album, like
an actual album,
an actual physical album.
Okay.
And it was sold, like it was to be sold for whatever, $1 million. And the owner had the choice of releasing the song to the public or keeping it for himself.
Wow.
Yeah. So that they would know if they heard the song out there that owner decided to release it, but he could just own it forever as his own song.
Wow.
Yeah. I wish.
Well, that's scarcity, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So musicians are kind of looking at this as, wait a minute. Maybe being shared millions of times isn't the way
isn't
I want to gain success.
Yeah. And it's different in the arts, and some art, you know, theater, again, it's how many people came to the show.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, that's right. So it's popularity compared to rarity.
Mm-hmm. Popularity and rarity. Yeah, there you go. Interesting.
Yeah.
So I don't know, just find it fascinating.
It is fascinating. So one of the other things that happened too with the artists is it's not just the copying, but it's the painting in the style of.
Okay.
And that started
happening. So mimicking.
Happening. Yeah, mimicking. Yeah, okay. And so then you're not actually copying and you're selling something that you're claiming is a Cézanne or a Degas. But if you're painting in the style of Degas and you're selling because it looks just like it could be a Degas, mm-hmm. that's kind of its own separate thing. Mm-hmm. You're not copying, but you're sort of copying. So it's not seen as forgery, but it's not original.
It's not original.
Yeah. And even if you have a signature that's similar to Degas, like yes. Degas. Yeah. So that was a big fad for quite a long time. And there's artists out there still doing that. It's just become so, ubiquitous.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a Van Gogh. Well, it's not really. Some guy that in, you know, wherever that made a sunflower that looked just like the Van Gogh.
Yeah.
The Van Gogh.
Well, that's not, I don't know. Well, we can't all have Van Goghs in our house.
No.
So how do we...
But then where's the value then, right? Like if you just love that...
You can have a poster of it.
Yeah, exactly. So if the value feels in the texture of the paint or something, mm-hmm. then you want the copy.
Mm-hmm.
But if the value is the original, but you can't have the original, do you want a poster, a big plastic thing in your house?
I don't know.
Or do you... You know, like, I mean, where is the person's value in terms of what art means to them?
And there are people who... So people who could paint like Van Gogh, are they... They're very good craftspeople, but are they necessarily artists?
That's right. That's a whole other discussion.
Yeah.
And you can be skilled and not be an artist.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Whew, okay.
Yeah, now my head
hurts.
That's
deep. Yeah, sorry. So I have one more thing.
Okay.
Unless we have to take a break.
We have 2 minutes.
We have 2 minutes. Okay. Yeah. So there's a guy, Christophe Petit.
Okay.
Right? And in his store, L'Art des Faux. Right?
L'Art des Faux.
L'Art des Faux. I'm so not French.
No, no,
L'Art
okay.
des Faux. L'Art des Faux.
Just means the art of fake.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He owns a Paris
Or my favorite is the Faux. Never mind. We'll talk about it after the break. Go ahead.
Okay. So he owns a Paris studio that employs 80 artists. 80.
80.
0 artists. Who copy the masters. That's what they do.
There you
go. And then they sell them. So they copy the masters. The thing is done absolutely perfectly to the master's original. But each piece is clearly marked so that there's no confusion at the museum. No curators will
They're
be harmed
in the
process.
They're not trying to pull the wool over anyone's eyes.
And they even embed a little piece of gold leaf in the paint of every piece so that it can be identified by x-ray as a copy. So, I mean, there's actual... Like, this is almost like a legitimate forgery service.
Yeah, awesome.
Yeah.
Way to That's turn cool. it on its head.
Yeah. I want to just delve briefly into the world of music. The reason that I thought about this is my kids, who listen to Fall Out Boy, have the song playing, and they don't know anything about the song. All they know is this song is called Uma Thurman.
Uma Thurman?
When I started talking to them about this, and I was talking about Uma Thurman, they're both like... Uma Thurman's a person? Like, they just no clue, right? Because everything's in the non-current world for them.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to explain to them, because in the song that Fall Out Boy sings, Uma Thurman, they talk about dance like Uma Thurman.
Okay.
So I was trying to explain in Pulp Fiction how she's this total, like, stand-up, straight-laced girl that doesn't talk, and then when she gets on the dance floor with John Travolta, she just lets loose, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't know about you, but if I was on the dance floor with John Travolta, I'd probably let loose too, right?
Yeah, I would imagine.
He's a good dancer.
He's a good dancer.
Anyway, yeah. So here's this song playing, and I said, that thing that I can hear is not their song. It's like the theme from the Munsters.
Wow.
Yeah, and it's right in the song. So I want to play it, and I think, I hope I'm allowed to do this because it's copyrighted. Can you hear that?
Yep.
Okay.
So, see?
I know, right? So I'm listening to this going, whoa!
Wait, you can't. But it happens all the time.
So it's not even just referencing another song.
No.
It's playing the other song.
In the middle of
your
song.
Yeah.
And yet there's special rules for that, isn't there?
I think so. And I think if you credit it, it's all okay. Mm-hmm. It just seems like just crediting it. I mean, it's not like an essay where you credit a quote that somebody
that's
did.
Right.
You're making money off of this. So it's a whole different thing going on now.
Hmm.
Yeah.
And I don't know, maybe it's just me, but I hear lots of songs and I think, well, they just took that from such and such a place.
Yeah. So there's been lawsuits, mm-hmm. right? Like Tom Petty just finished a whole big lawsuit, didn't he? And there was a couple, because some of them I'm not even hearing.
And the artist, Sam, what was his name? There wasn't a suit. They came to an agreement, but even he said, honestly, I don't remember ever hearing that music. So how, obviously it was in me. I couldn't appropriate it to
right.
someone, right?
He just, that kind of
right?
leaves it to question, like, is there anything original yes. out there left? Yeah. Because if you can't say,
and
yeah,
how do you
I heard
own
that
a combination of notes and sound?
Yeah, there's only 8 notes on the scale. I mean, it's only 26
incredible.
Letters in the alphabet. I mean, yeah. when do we get to a point where there is nothing left to be original?
I don't know. I think there'll always be some combination and permutation that's original. But
I think everything will have to reference something else,
yeah.
right?
But I mean, there's going to be similarities. But it's, again, to me, it's all about ownership. Who owns it?
Yeah.
You know, Tom Petty doesn't own that combination of notes.
Well, you're right.
And it surprises me that he would have gone there. And like this Munster thing, you know, mashups are totally legal or totally.
Yeah. Well, it's like very, well, I don't want to say trendy. It's the new art form.
Yeah.
And really, when you think about it, like Andy Warhol started this whole thing.
Yes.
Right? Where you take a corporate icon image and take
you
it.
Break it and bust it up and put it back together
yeah.
again. You're just re-upcycling or something. I don't know.
Yeah. So you're taking something existing, maybe something consumerist and banal, and mm-hmm. you're remaking it into
banal.
New art.
Mm-hmm.
And that's valid, right? Because you're trying to turn a message. You're trying to tell a message. You're telling a story.
Yes.
About what you're believing about, you know, whatever, consumerist lifestyle, whatever. Mm-hmm. And there's been lots of appropriation artists that have popped out in the last 30 years too.
Mm-hmm.
Like there's a guy,
and
an artist
on
Netflix right
now. Percentage. It's not really, to me, it's not about the percentage of what's the same. It's the percentage of what's different.
Yeah. Well, okay. There's a formula though,
yeah,
right?
I know for design, it's like 20% or something.
Oh really?
Yeah.
So if you change something 20%, it's new.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So
I mean, who makes that call? I don't know.
I know.
I've never.
Is there some mathematician
yeah.
sitting in the copyright
yeah.
office somewhere? Okay.
Could be. And
I'm
yet,
calculating this at 19.4%. It's not enough.
Not enough. And yet, you know, we live in a templated world.
Yeah.
And it's gross.
Yeah.
Like, no offense, but Vistaprint, really? You know?
Well.
Everybody's going to have the same business card at one point.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, in Hollywood, all the actresses are starting to look alike.
Yes.
Because they're all getting.
Same shoes, same boob job.
Same nose job, same eyes job,
yeah.
same hair, same every. Come on.
Yeah. So
what happened to originality?
We have to work very hard to be individual in our life. I'm not going to say unique or original, but be your own individual.
Well, that's so interesting that you said it that way. We have to work very hard to be original.
Yes.
So maybe,
or individual.
Yeah.
It's like we can't all be original. I mean, we're going to be a combination of things.
Yeah.
But
because we're kind of product. I mean, right now, especially, right? We're product of media influence,
yeah.
People, social norms, you know, mm-hmm. all that stuff. So we are kind of products of things that influence us and make us
global,
think certain.
And it's global, too. Like if you go to.
Yeah.
I know years ago when I went to Europe, I'd say, boy, you can really tell it's different here. And then I went back like 10 years ago and all of a sudden it's like, oh my gosh, we're all starting to look the same. The Italians aren't wearing leather shoes. They're wearing Nike runners and Abercrombie and Fitch, you know, zip up hoodies. And like, we're all going to look the same.
Yeah.
I don't like it.
No.
No.
So you're right. We do have to
yeah.
actually work at it then.
Because it's
work
easy
to
go the templated route, and it's easy to pick the off-the-shelf solution, right?
Yeah.
Even house design, for heaven's sakes, you can go online and pick something off the shelf.
Yeah.
It's, you know, we have to, I think it's a personal discipline to not take the easy way out.
Right.
Yeah.
It's
And
it,
I mean, a lot of forgers and counterfeiters, you know, that's
well,
what they're doing.
Easy
they're
money.
Taking the
right?
easy way out.
Because they didn't have to come up with the idea themselves.
Mm-hmm.
If you can copy, all you need is the skill. You
mm-hmm.
don't need the creativity behind it.
Mm-hmm. So the creativity piece is important too.
It is.
I mean, how many logos, you know, are we ever going to run out of logos? No, because there's always a combination and permutation of elements that, right? But
yeah.
I can tell you, I can look at any any sort of corporate design and tell you whether or not it's original or templated.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. And I see the templates as counterfeit in a way.
Huh.
Because I think, come on, that's not you.
So you mean people are doing logo designs based on what they've searched off the internet?
The other one is 99 designs. Like you can see maybe on Facebook, it'll say, get a brand new brand mark for $5. Really? What can you get for $5?
Yeah. Well, you get something that 500 people have already purchased. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, you know, a lot of times we take the easy way out. Like, look at contests and, right?
I know.
That's actually speculative work. Yeah. You know, that's another form of fraud. But on the other side, not from the producer, from the person who's asking for the work.
Right. Well, asking for the work for free under the guise of a contest is, yeah, it's something that burns a lot of our bottoms.
I think it's right up there with counterfeit and forgery.
Yeah, it is. Except, yeah, you're right. It's coming from the corporate side.
Yeah. And I have a cold. And when I have a cold, I have no patience. So I seem a little cranky today. I apologize. But
well, we're seeing
it. I don't have time for subtleties right now.
I know, but we're seeing it in our own community. It's not just that awful Canada 150 logo contest, but in our own community this happens.
Yeah, don't disguise it. If you're asking for free stuff, you're asking for free stuff.
Yeah.
That's as simple as that. Don't disguise it as a contest or an opportunity to, you know.
Yeah, opportunity to expose your work.
Expose your work.
Or and you'll have an opportunity to sell your work.
To do good.
Because you can put a label on it.
Let's just call it.
Well, yeah.
You're totally cheaping out here.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you're not going to get what you needed because you're not prepared to put the work into, like, the research and the objectives and everything that goes into deciding on whether it's, you know, could be anything creative that's going to add unique value to your business or your organization.
Yeah.
It has value and you rob it of its value the minute you say, I know, let's have a contest.
Yeah. Or let's have an, okay, I'm sorry.
Let's
have an exhibition. Yeah. Like there is a business in this community who is having an opportunity for artists to apply to exhibit their work in this place of business, that which is not a gallery. So, and then in the whole opportunity, stupid write-up thing, it's like, well, you'll have an opportunity to sell your work because you can put a label with your price on it.
That is just a free service.
Yeah. That is a free service that they're getting artists to provide rather than purchasing or even doing an art rental, which is really cheap, right? Like you don't have to go too far afield to find an artist who's willing to lend their work for a year at a time for, $200 or $300. I mean, come
on.
And
it's a write-off.
Yeah. But they're not willing to go down that road. They're going to offer this little free opportunity.
Well, that or, in my view, go to Winners and buy some stuff that's not licensed, that looks pretty. That's fine.
Yeah.
Because if you're really, totally, genuinely interested in the art, you will, right?
Yeah.
And so that would be my caution is watch out for, there's fraudsters on both sides.
Yeah.
The people who are commissioning the work and the people who are making the work.
Yes.
So look for, and it's true. I mean, that word authentic and authenticity and, it's so overused, but we know it.
Well, that's the thing.
Right.
And I don't know what you're saying about authenticity being overused, but that's really what we're looking for here. It's not necessarily about having to be original, being unique, first time only, that kind of stuff.
It's
about real.
Yes.
What is real?
Exactly. And so, or what's going to happen again, I'm sick, I'm tired, I'm a little bit cranky. We're all going to be wearing the same outfit, driving the same car, and all our houses are going to look the same.
Yeah. Homogeneous.
Yes.
Homo something.
Yeah, homogeneous. Boring.
Yeah, right? Exactly.
I know I go to houses, we can't all live in an IKEA bubble, like you can go into someone's house and say, winners, IKEA, 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 right? You get it. So we are not, it's true we live in the area of mass consumerism, but you can still find room to be an individual.
Yes.
Yeah.
I agree.
Yeah. And it's something I really struggle with.
Well, as a designer and as an artist, we certainly do. Because we're trying to convince people all the time that there's value in originality.
Or you see like $1 million home with $24 artwork on the wall and you think, come on.
Yeah. I just think that some people don't understand the arts. They don't understand what it is. There's same within music, same within literature. They just they're not making the effort to understand where the value is, why they feel good about it, why it makes sense to them, right? They
don't. Yeah. What does this, where does this piece, I mean, I guess the difference is, and in fairness, you know, you and I are a lot like this. We're trying to curate our own lives.
Yeah. Right?
I want to surround myself with things that have meaning to mm-hmm. me. And they might be stupid things. Like, I love Pez dispensers because they're colorful and they're practical and blah, blah, whatever.
Yeah.
This is not exactly high art, but I love Pez dispensers and I have Pez dispensers at my house. But people who know me know that. So it's a good fit. I would never put things, surround my life with things that are
that you think
fake
other people,
and phony that other people will say, oh, did you see your house? Doesn't look nice.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
That's right.
And now,
as the art world turns, a dramatic moment in the arts.
So speaking of like kind of fooling people, a couple of weeks ago when we had Sachi on here with a literature topic.
Yes.
She was so surprised sitting in the studio here that we weren't saying that. Like the dramatic
moments.
Oh, really? She's like, what? That's recorded? All this time I thought
That's
you guys
so
did
funny.
It every time.
You know, when I was little, I used to think that commercials on TV were redone every time. And I'd be like, man, they really nailed that. It looks exactly like it did last time.
That is so funny.
You just assume, right?
It's like,
and I would watch and I'd be like, oh, still, it looks so much like
the
it did
best
last time.
Theater ever.
Yeah.
Those guys did it the same as they did it last time and the time before.
Yeah.
Oh, that is hilarious.
So yes, those are pre-recorded, the dramatic moments in the art.
Okay, so today's dramatic moment is this wealthy art collector and patron of the arts, Mark Landis.
Mm.
Yeah, this was a BBC story recently. He's
yes.
just been found out to be a forger, an art forger, and donor. So he has not...
Ooh, so he's... Wow.
I know. So he has not benefited financially from a single one of the works that he created.
Well, he's just messing with us.
He is.
Yeah.
And he's been donating for years, since the 80s, to museums. And so what he does is, apparently, the very first time he did it to impress his mom.
Aww.
To be a donor, donate to a museum,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
But I guess he liked the feeling
mm-hmm.
because he started to do more, and he found out what museums were collecting, and then he would create those works, and then he would go to that museum. Here, I've got a donation of this. And they'd be like, yeah, thank you. This is awesome. We'll put it on public display right away. And this went on for years and years, and he used the cheapest materials. You go to Woolworths and Walmart and use coffee for the staining.
Really?
And yeah. Cheap, cheap, cheap. But he was,
connecting to someone's need to get something
yes,
for free to make
right.
them better.
Yeah. And
wow.
So I think that, like, and this is not new. He was probably not found out for all of these years because curators, once they discovered that they had been tricked,
yes,
they were too embarrassed to release that information. So they would just quietly tuck that piece back into the basement
never
storage.
To be spoken of again.
Yeah. And so
yeah, we're quite vain, aren't we?
We are.
Yeah.
Well, like I said before, the experts don't like it when they've been shown to be wrong.
No.
And so everything is to prevent being seen as not the expert.
Mm-hmm.
So they would just tuck it away. No, I don't know where that piece went. It's in long-term collection.
Yes.
We're preserving it. We're restoring it.
Restoring it.
So wow. Finally, one of the museum curators, after having two pieces donated by this guy, and I mean, we're talking like hundreds of pieces. After having two pieces, the guy actually Googled it and discovered that not only did this guy, Mark Landis, donate the same piece of one of the artists to another museum less than a year earlier, but the second piece, also identical to a piece he donated to another museum on the other side of the continent within a year.
So he got sloppy.
He got sloppy. He got excited and just kept going and going and going.
Wow.
So finally, this curator was willing to say, okay, he fooled me. I took these into my collection. I'm happy. Gave him a nice tax receipt. And now I'm I've been shown to have been mistaken.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the beginning
God
of
forbid
all.
God forbid someone should make a mistake.
I know. Well,
we make mistakes all the time.
Yeah. And so then all of these curators coming out of the woodwork, oh, yeah, I've got some of his.
It's like confession time.
Yeah. And it just all has been, snowballed and is a lot.
And it would have been easier to do, even 20 years ago. But now with the internet, it's probably a bit harder to do.
Well, yeah, because every time something like that happens, or every time an authentic patron donates a piece of work to a museum, you make a big Facebook deal out of it. You have a thank you on the wall, right? Yeah. Like, it's a big deal. Mm-hmm. There's a press release. And so it's easy to find that information now.
And so, yeah, and I guess, it's just process. You have to have a process to authenticate.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is harder and harder now.
Well, I would imagine.
I mean, even with all the amazing technology, it also means the technology to discover it is available to the people with the skills to use the technology to create it in the first place. Mm-hmm. And so they can make things appear aged and test aged. I mean, it's just...
Wow. And now
it's getting like very technical.
3D printing, people will be able to make Michelangelo's David if they want.
Out of plastic.
A pretty big printer, but...
A gigantic plastic David.
Yeah, there's no end to... And yet some people, like, fake for a living, movie people.
Yeah.
Special effects, this is all faked stuff.
Oh,
and yet we celebrate how awesomely fake it is. Did you see those effects? Wouldn't we call them effects? Did you see the special effects?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, what was interesting is I was having a conversation with a friend of one of my kids.
Yeah.
Who's pretty excited about the new Star Wars movie.
Oh, yes.
That's coming out. And he said it's like three different worlds that these Star Wars trilogies came out. The first one, they used puppets for, all of the sort of unusual creatures and had to use actual set designers to create the environments. The second group was like early CG, so really kind of bad special effects. But, it was the first time that they were able to use green screen.
Yes.
For, to create a world. And then now in these super computer generated special effects, green screen stuff, where nothing's real anymore. Like the actors are barely having to wear a costume. They just jump around in front of a blue screen or a green screen. And they're put in the environment and facing their crazy enemy that has eight arms. And so he said, it's such an interesting kind of, story to put in these three different worlds of our advancement through the arts.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that was kind of interesting that now we'll be able to compare.
I wonder if we'll swing back a little bit.
To do something
to movies that are actually just shot normally, just a camera and no green screen, no special effects.
Oh, there still are for sure, because there are, what do you call those guys, purists that still use film.
Yes.
They won't use digital.
Huh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is, it's the only reason Kodak still exists in some form.
It's because of the movie industry.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they say it looks different.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. haven't really noticed myself. But yeah. And then there's people that try to do those one take films, right? Where you just roll the camera
and
it's in real time.
Yeah.
And you just make a movie.
Real time.
Yeah. So no
even
editing.
That concept of real time as opposed to what? Fake time.
Fake time.
Yeah.
Movies have always been about making up an artificial world though, right? So it's kind of been our... I don't know.
Storytelling. But now you can make a movie with just a green screen and a computer.
Yeah, that's true. Like some guy in his basement can make a movie now.
Yes.
You hardly even need the real live actors, really. Because you can, of course, the animated movies, like the things that Pixar are putting out.
Right. Or hand-drawn versus computer animated. Mm-hmm. Right? It's been a while since we've had a hand-drawn.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even
know. And they don't do as well as the computer animated ones.
No.
But it still started in someone's head, I guess.
It did. And there's still, I think the animators are still artists who are working. Like, I remember seeing a little documentary on the animators who worked on Beauty and the Beast, the animated version, and how they did the hair on the Beast. And it was really a complicated process. They had to really, little hairs one at a time.
Wow.
Motioning just to program into the computer what moving hair looks like, hair in the wind, like especially when it's fur.
Yes.
What was the other one too? I can't remember. Not Lion King, but something else along those lines where there was fur and they had to figure out how fur moved when the wind came across it, like in a wheat field.
Yeah.
And so that was, some artist had to program that into a computer.
Yeah, yeah.
So they're there still.
Right. And so it's a tool, like anything, like a pencil. It'll do whatever you want it to do. But it's when the technology takes over the creativity where I start to feel like it's not the point.
Yeah, yeah, that's true.
Right?
That's when we start
to enable, not disable.
Yeah,
yeah.
The blurred lines.
Exactly.
And then we're not even sure what's original and what, and we're not even sure what's truth and what's a story anymore.
It's all about manufacturing, right?
Well, and then there's media, which we used to trust as being always truthful. And now we discover that there's a lot of manufactured facts and situations.
Oh, yeah. Dude, there's a whole topic.
Yeah, by itself. Okay, yeah. I get it. We're getting the red card.
The red card.
So
maybe he works for the traditional media and he doesn't want us
talking about that. Yeah, we're getting the cut the neck off thing.
That's right.
Yeah. Stop talking about media. All right. Well, we have a few minutes to talk about upcoming events.
Yes.
So guess what we're doing right now at the gallery?
What are we doing?
We're installing the new exhibition. Of course you know.
But no, and by we, you mean you and Eric.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's be honest.
Well, okay, after Kathy Stubbington's show, I tell you, anything after this is going to be a breeze. But last night we were installing the new exhibition, which is Jeff Wilson's Coastal Paintings.
Oh, they're beautiful.
They are so beautiful. Mm-hmm. They're so bright. So here's a guy. He's from Scotland. He's just got the most awesome Scottish accent.
Really?
Oh, yes.
Cool.
And he was talking about, because he has two small paintings and they're studies for these big ones, right? And he said, you can choose the wee ones if you want. You could show the wee ones next to the other. Or just take the wee ones down. Like, oh my God, that's so cute.
I know. We'll have to record them. Can you say wee ones again?
So anyway, he's going to be there on opening night, which is this Friday. And all of his pieces are all about the big machinery of the West Coast.
Very cool.
Yeah. And actually he's got a couple of pieces from across the pond as well. So a couple of big ships and a little double-decker bus too. So it's kind of interesting for people who love the machinery, but it's also interesting for people who love the big splashy paint where you just recognize the light, the way light bounces off of metal and just some of those, like I said, the banal things like tires on a Feller Buncher machine, how it looks when it's been grinding through the forest. I don't know. There's just some delightful brushstrokes there.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So
vibrant and, oh, it's really great.
Yeah. So it's kind of it's a celebration of resource extraction.
Yes.
But it's also a celebration of bold color.
By land, sea.
By land, air, and sea.
Air and sea.
Yeah.
And there's an airplane, the beaver.
Yes.
Oh, I love that.
The flying beaver. Yeah. It's the, what do you call it? De Havilland? Is that the
one? De Havilland, yeah.
Yeah. There's only one, he said. Only one yellow flying beaver.
Aww.
Living, not living.
But still
in existing.
In Vancouver, on the coast.
I don't know if he meant just on the coast or if all of Canada, but his painting of the yellow beaver, he said, that's the only one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So if you're an airplane nut like I am, you'll appreciate it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And a boat person, if you like boats.
Yes.
Yeah. Anyway, it'll be a fun show. So he's also going to be here for the artist talk on April 16th. Is that right? The third Thursday of the month.
Yes.
So he'll talk about his work, and he's got great stories about some of the ships that are in the show,
Excuse
too.
Me.
He's just a really interesting guy, and he's just fun to listen to. Mm-hmm. Maybe we're so not diverse in Salmon Arm that when somebody from away comes, we're like, oh my God, just talk more.
Can you keep talking? Keep talking.
So opening night this Friday, April 3rd, which yes, it is Good Friday.
Yes.
But we're going ahead anyway with an opening night because anything after 3 p.m. is good to go.
That's right.
Yeah.
Because Lent is over.
Yeah. So you can come and eat and have a glass of wine, meet the artist and celebrate.
Mm-hmm.
And
there goes the religious thing again. That's weird.
I know. Well, it's like you said, it's a holy week. Maybe
holy
we could
week.
Help ourselves.
Holy week.
We're
having one of those weeks.
Yes, we are. And so once again, I'd like to acknowledge our awesome sponsor, Warren Welter. Thank you, Warren, for sponsoring Artscape. This week, you are the innovation catalyst at Creatability, and we appreciate your original design and your ideas that help keep Salmon Arm vibrant and exciting and unique and different. And people come to Salmon Arm and see that film reel and see the apples with the tractor seeds. And they remember Salmon Arm.
That's right.
Because everything is about those moments, right? Those little moments that make you think, oh, that's different.
That's different.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So thank you, Warren. And thank you all for joining us this week on Artscape. I'm Tracy Kutchker.
And I'm Louise Wallace Richmond.
Have a great April Fool's Day. And maybe it's April Fool's week.
Yes.